This is program C-1098. We have now arrived in our study of the Jewish-Roman War to the actual siege of Jerusalem. The new emperor, Vespasian, left his son Titus in Judea to finish the war. And that was effectively for him to go up to Jerusalem, surround the city, and force compliance from the rebels in giving the city back to the control of legitimate authority. Now, Titus set up his Roman encampments on Mount Scopus right around the beginning of the Passover season. So just a few days before Passover was scheduled to start. Passover began in the middle of April that year. It'll go for 7 days. And I think, even though Josephus doesn't really clearly comment on this, I think that Titus's mindset was he knew that he would need to have good relationships with Jewish people in the future. So he needs to do the least amount of damage to the temple complex and to any worshipers that are going to be participants in a religious ceremony, a religious festival. So he's trying to avoid that sort of future problem. So instead, he kind of just waits there to the north and a little bit to the east until Passover is over. Now, in the meantime, he does start clearing some of the land of obstacles between his encampment and the northern wall of the city of Jerusalem. And the Jewish rebels actually attack the Roman engineers that are out there trying to clear that area. And this causes a lot of trouble for Titus. He actually gets after some of his soldiers because they got sucked into a false retreat by the Jews and got a bunch of their people killed. Titus is trying his best to keep his own men under control and to still keep Jewish opinion favorable toward him once it's all been taken care of. Now, Josephus, who is an eyewitness of all these things, who is effectively a military associate of Titus, he is keeping records or using the records of the Romans to let us know what the military strength of the opposing forces are. Now, he's told us that there's about 3 legions plus auxiliaries and independent armies like that of King Agrippa II, who are part of this force that's going to besiege Jerusalem. So you know from that that's well into a couple of 10,000s of soldiers. Here are the figures that are given by Josephus for the opposing force. Simon of Gadara, who has control of Western Jerusalem, has a total of about 15,000 men under his command. That's 10,000 Jewish soldiers under 50 commanders, and 5,000 Idumean soldiers under their commanders, because this guy is an Idumean, but Idumeans were Jewish by their religion, and therefore he is interested in protecting the Jewish faith from any type of Roman interference. But he does not like the other Jewish leader in Jerusalem. He sees him as a troublemaker, and so he's opposed to him. His name is John of Giscala. John of Giscala is from Galilee. He gave Josephus fits whenever both of them were supposed to be cooperating military commanders against the Romans. In fact, he tried to kill Josephus at one point. Well, he has now come and seized control of the zealot forces in Jerusalem, particularly in the temple itself and the immediate area of the lower city around it. He has about 8,400 men under his command, so less than John by, or less than Simon by quite a bit. 6,000 of his own soldiers are under 20 commanders, and 2,400 of his soldiers are under his direct, are under the command of Eleazar, who is the rebel security force leader of the temple that John has kind of forced to come under his control recently. Now, based on later casualty reports, we know that there's around 1 million citizens, that is, non-combatants, in the city during this time. They came for the Passover and apparently, very foolishly, chose to stay after the Passover was over. Even though they knew the Roman soldiers, the Roman legions, were just outside of the city. Now, keep in mind that the Romans had not yet put a cordon around the city of Jerusalem. All of these civilians would have been able to depart if they had wished to do so. There was still free movement up until the end of the Feast of Tabernacles, when the Romans put a cordon around the city. And so that happened on the 22nd day of the first Jewish month. That becomes our official first day of the siege. And that is Titus, sends his soldiers around to capture anyone leaving the city thereafter, and to also start trying to assault the western wall of the city of Jerusalem, which would be the territory of Simon of Gadara. Now, the Jewish people try to stop the building of any siege works. They even pull out some of the Roman artillery pieces that they'd captured back in 66 when they destroyed the retreating Roman legion of Cestius. Now, they hadn't known how to use this equipment. It takes some training, but they had figured out at least enough so that they could fire some artillery. Now, when we're talking about artillery, we're talking about first century AD artillery, which would be large stones of several hundred pounds, and also large bolts, that is, large arrows that could crash up against a material or hit infantry, and then multi-firers, which would be equipment that could fire a whole bunch of arrows at the exact same time. So the Jews are using that equipment plus what they already knew how to use, which would be sling stones and bows and arrows, to try to cause trouble for those that were building the siege ramps and the siege equipment. Now, on the 15th day of the siege, so that'd be the 7th day of the second Jewish month, Titus broke through the western wall of Jerusalem, and he moved into the upper city, the new city of Jerusalem, which would be to the west of the temple. And then 5 days later, he broke through a second wall on that side of town and got into the commercial area of the city of Jerusalem, immediately west of the temple. Now, Josephus reports that Titus very much wanted to avoid civilian casualties and collateral damage. But once he got inside the streets of Jerusalem, up in that region, he ended up with some of his soldiers getting caught in what we today would refer to as a Black Hawk Down situation, where he had a small force of his soldiers that got lost in these back streets as they tried to get back with their unit, their larger unit. And they didn't know who were non-combatants and who were rebels, And there was a lot of fighting going on back and forth, and it was an absolute mess. And Josephus talks an awful lot about that incident. Now, on that same day, though, Titus started building siege ramps against the Tower of Antonia, which is on the northwest corner of the temple, and the temple itself on that northwest side. And so his goal is that he's going to try to break into both of those places and from there assault the Jewish rebels who have control of the shrine building, because he wants control of the shrine building for himself. On the 24th day of the siege, Titus used very overwhelming force to force his way through a second wall into another part of the commercial district. And Titus, at that time, decides to use a little psychological warfare, because now he has the northwest corner of the city of Jerusalem under his control, and that includes the commercial districts. He has a siege ramp, a siege operation that's being carried out against the Tower of Antonia and against the northern temple courtyard that's going very, very well. And so it should be clear that after only, you know, about a month's operation, that the Romans are going to be successful in retaking the city. There should be zero doubt about that to the Jewish people that are trying to hold out. So he decides to psychologically give them some time to consider surrender. And he does this in this strange fashion. Because it's time to pay his troops their monthly pay, he suspends any active military operation and lines up his legions one day at a time in military parade, which means they have to put their dress uniform on and line up in their ranks, and he pays them one legion at a time. And it takes him 4 days to get through the four legions that he now has under his control. And the report of Josephus is that the Jewish people were lining the walls where they could see the dress parade area where this was happening. And so for 4 days, they get to see the entirety of the military force that's against them looking their best and getting their pay and carrying on their normal military lifestyle. And that should have been sufficient to warn the Jewish people, this is who will come in and take you if you don't surrender. And so he gives them a fifth day on which to think this over and to surrender. And of course, we know they don't. So he starts his siege back up again, and he tells Josephus that he wants him to go around the perimeter of the city every day, speaking to the Jewish people up on the wall in their own language, presumably, and convince them it is absolutely insane to keep resisting the Roman army and to offer to them safe passage if they wish to surrender. And now he's talking to some of the civilians, understand. He wants the civilians to leave of their own free will and come out of the military operation zone. He would also like to have some of the soldiers to surrender as well, but he's particularly focused on the majority civilian population. And a lot of the civilians, or some of the civilians, did sneak out to the Romans. And this leads to some other atrocities that we read about in Josephus. Some of the Jewish civilians would swallow coins in order to sneak by anybody that they ran across in the street to get get their money passed a couple of different levels of cordon. And some of the Jewish people found out that was happening, and so they would kill them and gut them. And unfortunately, some of the legionaries, some of the Roman soldiers, I think it was actually auxiliaries, so these would be fresh Roman troops that had not been long on the job, they found out this was happening, and they would start butchering anyone and everyone and going through their guts to try to, and their stomachs to try to find these coins. Titus was furious when he found out it was happening and actually invoked martial law against his own troops, executed those that would engage in such behavior. Now, inside the city, though, you can appreciate by the time May rolled around, there was an awful lot of mouths that could not be fed anymore. They had eaten up all the supplies that had been there earlier in the year, and now they are fighting for scraps amongst each other. And of course, the military guys are using their force, their weaponry, to make the civilians give up their supplies to them. And there's even some horrible torture that goes on in order to find out where the food is. In the 67th day of the siege, so that'd be late June of 70, the Romans finished constructing what we would call today a security fence around the city. It was effectively a wall that was high enough that it could not be climbed over easily, and there were patrols of Romans going all around it on a regular basis, so that now there's no way for the Jewish people to sneak out without running into a Roman, and there's no way anybody can sneak in with supplies. And so this is the guarantee that the city is going to be taken by Rome shortly. And I remind you again of Jesus' warning, his words, that unless God shortened these days, there wouldn't have been a single person survive this siege of Jerusalem. So now we come to the 83rd day of the siege, and that would be the middle of July of 70. The Romans now seized control of the Antonia Tower, and Titus brings his army into that fortress so that they could do a final push on the temple. Now, keep in mind that the Tower of Antonia had for a long time been the protecting fortress for the city of Jerusalem, and specifically for the Temple Mount itself. So once you have control of that, it is not all that hard to take control of the Temple Mount itself. So we are now coming very close to the end of the siege by the standards of the Romans. On the 88th through the 90th day of the siege, so that would be still in July, the rebels in the temple tried to stop the Romans from advancing from the Antonia Tower region, and they started burning some of the connected places between the two. And Josephus says this is actually the beginning of the burning of the temple itself, because he counted this area that just got demolished and burnt as part of the temple complex proper. Then we come to the 93rd day of the siege, and this was a really bad day for the Romans because the Jewish rebels had booby-trapped the entire western portico of the Temple Mount. This is the roof-covered porch that allowed worshipers to gather out of the sun, out of the rain, as part of their worship right next to the western side of the temple. Well, since the Jews knew that the Romans were about to take that area, they soaked the rafters with oil and they put all sorts of flammable items up there in the rafters. And when the Romans got on the top of that portico with their soldiers, the Jews set that on fire. And the Romans that were part of that push ended up dying in the fire, or jumping out of the fire to their death below, or being killed by any Jews that happened to be able to get to them. So it was a really bad day. But it's also the time that the famine is reaching its climax. There are stories about a woman that was crashed in by rebels. They smelled food cooking, and they wanted to know what she had, and it turned out that she was cooking her own kid. And that bothered a lot of Jewish people, because that was one of the prophecies of old, that when they were out of covenant with God and God sent foreign armies against them, they would descend into cannibalism itself because of the siege that they'd be under. So it was a really bad time period. Now we come to the 8th day of the 5th month. That's the 104th day of the siege. And Titus had another bad day, because he lost a lot of his men and equipment, and he almost lost one of his military standards, which were very important to the legions. When he was trying to break through the northern gate of the inner temple without causing damage, or too much damage, to the temple itself. Remember, I've told you, he is trying his best to keep damage to the temple at a minimum, and the death of non-combatants amongst the Jews to a minimum, because his anticipation is they are going to go back to having regular relationships with the Jews once they get these rebels under control. So he's trying his best to keep this at a minimum, but now he's losing men because of that action. And so he finally gives permission for a shortcut method of breaking into the temple, which was setting fire to that gate. Now, that fire quickly spread into the porticos of the inner court. Now, remember, the shrine building is the great big building that has the Holy of Holies at the back side of it and the holy place at the front side of it. Now, there's a courtyard immediately around it, and then there's a portico that forms the perimeter for those courtyards. So they're breaking into that courtyard area, but when they set fire to that courtyard gate, they ended up setting fire to the surrounding portico. So we've actually got fire not very far away from the temple building itself now. And now that brings us to the 9th day of the 5th month, which was the 105th day of the siege. It's basically the beginning of August in 70. And Titus meets with his commanders in his command tent, because he needs to have their input on what to do with the shrine building. Now, some of the commanders said, you ought to just demolish it, because clearly these Jewish rebels, they see this as a rallying point. They're using it as their citadel, their headquarters building, and we've got to put this rebellion down with strong force. Others were saying that they shouldn't do that. That probably the advice that they were giving was something that I was talking about that Titus had in his mind already, and that is that eventually the goal is to go back to normal Jewish-Roman relations. If they destroy this temple, that's going to be very hard to do. In the end, Titus expressed his own conviction that they were there to fight the rebels, not the building. And so his goal was to try and keep the building from being destroyed. And especially since it's a magnificent building. Remember, this is the renovation of the second temple by King Herod. It is an amazing structure. And so he wants to keep it intact. So at the end of that day, the end of that day's conference, he ordered that the fires in the portico should be put out. And that the next day they should all be ready to go into the shrine building itself and eradicate the remaining rebels that were hiding out inside that building. And so that was his goal. When the sun goes down, he goes to his tent to try to rest. And we've now come to the 10th day of the 5th month of the Jewish year, which is the 106th day of the siege. And Josephus points to this day as being auspicious. He says, quote, "But as for that house, God had for certain long ago doomed it to the fire, and now that fatal day was come, according to the revolution of ages, it was the 10th day of the month Lus, or Ab, upon which it was formerly burnt by the king of Babylon," end quote. So he takes note that the 10th day of the 5th month was the exact day that the Babylonians set fire to the shrine building back in 587 BC when the first temple was destroyed. And so now it's going to be that this temple building, this shrine building, will be set fire to on the exact same calendar day. Now the Jewish people go with a post-Bible tradition that it was the 9th day of Ab that those two events happened. And I disagree with that. I think all of the scriptural evidence and all the historical evidence says that the firing took place on the 10th. And so I think that we should stand with the better evidence rather than the rabbinical traditions that come later. Well, we're out of time today. Come back tomorrow and we'll kind of finish our series up.